alarm has been sounded repeatedly. Get these nasty invasive species early. Our guest today will probably agree with that, but as for the nasty part, not so much. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The issue of invasive species overlaps with all sorts of other ones. For instance, predator management, evolutionary biology. The toll-free number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. Oh yes, and food security and public land management and more today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So it's a gentle-looking little tome written by a garden writer and college professor in the United Kingdom entitled Where Do Camels Belong? Until you open it up and you discover that it's really kind of a screed against all the alarmism about endangered species. Fascinating. We shouldn't be scared of endangered species, so I invited him on the show. Ken Thompson is author of Where Do Camels Belong? Why Invasive Species Aren't All Bad, and he joins us from his home in Sheffield, United Kingdom. Ken, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Nice to be on the show.
So, where do camels belong anyway, so long as we start with that?
Yeah, that's a good place to start, isn't it? Camels are the reason the book's called Where Do Camels Belong is camels are just a neat way of exploring the whole idea of where species ought to be, because underlying the whole idea of invasive alien species is that there are places species ought to be and there are places species ought not to be. And we kind of have an idea that that's quite easy, really. We know where species should be and we know where they shouldn't be. But camels are interesting because if you look carefully at camels, it's not easy to tell. Because if you ask anyone, if you just stop anyone in the street and say, where do camels belong? They'll very likely say North Africa or Egypt or the Middle East or something like that.
Yeah, right. I see it on the cigarette pack. You got the camel and you got the pyramid right next to it.
Exactly. The cigarette packet camels with the pyramid in the background, of course.
And then there's some other camel that lives someplace else that's got two humps, I think, also. I know that.
Yeah, there is another camel. There is another camel which is in Asia, which is the two-humped camel. But they're not the only camels that exist. In fact, there are six species of camels alive in the world today. One of them is the one on the cigarette packet, and one is the one with two humps in Asia. And the other four are in South America because alpacas and llamas and those kinds of things are camels. They just don't happen to have humps, but there's nothing in the rule book says that a camel has to have a hump. They are definitely camels. So if you're just counting species, there are twice as many in South America as there are in the Middle East and Asia. So that's one problem with where camels belong. The other is that camels evolved long ago, at least 40 million years ago, in North America. And for a long time, there were many species of camels in North America, of all shapes and sizes, all over the country. And in fact, they spread to South America relatively recently, and also across the Bering Strait, which is the Bering region, which is near where you are now, into Asia, also relatively recently. So all the living camels that we have in the world are relatively recent arrivals now. And very recently, in fact, only about 8,000 years ago, the last surviving North American camel went extinct, almost certainly wiped out by early humans. So that you begin to see now the problem with answering the question, where do camels belong? Because if by that you mean where they evolved and where there was the greatest diversity of camels and where they lived for the longest time, there's really only one answer to that question, and it's North America.
I'm going to throw back a quote from your book, Where Do Camels Belong, at this point. Really kind of in the nutgraph area where you're making your case and summing it up. You say, the view of the biosphere you learned in school of natural biomes disturbed to varying extremes by humans is seriously out of date. The modern world is essentially a mosaic of new anthropogenic biomes, croplands, plantations, settlements, cities, rangelands, with here and there natural ecosystems embedded within them. So what I get from so many of the examples in your book is that the alarm about endangered species is often some species that is that is predisposed towards the very conditions that humans create on the planet. And so it's because we're close to it and we created the conditions, and so then we sound the alarm.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the original invasive species is Homo sapiens, obviously, and we've totally transformed the world, almost all of it, and in doing so, we have often made it not really very good for the species that used to live there. Hence all the species these days which are rare or endangered or, in fact, even extinct. And at the same time, we have made the world much better for a bunch of other species. Now, some of these other species, which, like the things we've done, are natives. They're species that were there already. But many of them, not surprisingly, are species that we've brought from other continents. Very often, blaming the alien species for that state of affairs is really a bit futile, really, because it's really man that's at the root of the problem. I mean, camels are just one example. You know, there are no camels in North America because we killed them. There are no, you know, horses evolved in North America, but horses had to be brought back to North America by man because we killed them. Right across the world, we killed all the large animals, you know. I mean, Australia had wombats the size of buses, you know, until the Aborigines turned up and killed them all. It's just amazing the way the world has changed in relatively recent past, and it's all due to us, really.
Well, we do have, in Alaska, some of the archaeology is verifying the kind of thing that you're talking about in terms of, and I've heard it also said about rainforest and the patch agriculture and so forth like that, that the indigenous people in the rainforest were actually managing it through their practices. They were encouraging certain kinds of plants that advantaged them and so forth. And this goes back a long, long ways. And we discover the same deal out in the Alaska Peninsula, an area that actually World War II totally depopulated. In other words, everybody was just moved off of there.
Yep.
But there had been, but going back in the archaeology, you discover a long, long history of people in a coexistence with a very turbulent environment that would adapt to whatever it was the environment threw at them. And they were whalers, they were shellfishers, they were everything, whatever was called for at the time. And they indeed did modify the landscape. And we're talking about an area where the trees haven't got, by the way, Ken.
Yep.
It's always fun to me to go out to the Alaska Peninsula and realize I'm looking at a few trees here and there, and they're just the first ones to get there. It's not like it's not suitable habitat for trees. It's just that they take a long time getting there. And I think that's one of the big problems with this whole invasive species thing is that human beings can't take a long view of things. If you can take a long view, then you see, and indeed the experts say that often these species simply run themselves out. They get so overpopulated or whatnot, or become vulnerable to disease, or turn out can be outcompeted over the long run, and they don't necessarily last. But in the meanwhile, they can be a big nuisance, especially in disturbed ground and other conditions that humans themselves have created.
Yeah, yeah. We think we live a long time. You know, we think if you're lucky, you live to be 100. But honestly, that's a really short period of time. And most of us don't even think on that kind of time scale. Most of us don't think much beyond, the time of the next election. And we just don't understand what a changeable and dynamic place the world is and how you have to go back really not very far to find a world that would have felt very, very unfamiliar with different climates and different species and, you know, the same species in very different places and so on. And so we have this myth, really, that the world is sort of fixed and unchanging. And because we think that anything that changes it, we think that anything that's moved from one place to another, we think that's bad. Whereas, in fact, species have been moving around the planet all over the place for hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah, we're talking with Ken Thompson, author of Where Do Camels Belong? Why Invasive Species Aren't All Bad. And Ken, you're not going to tell me that the zebra mussel is not damaging. I mean, it fouls pipes. It does all kinds of things.
No, I'm not going to tell you it's not damaging, but I am going to tell you that when it comes to alien species, we need to pick our fights with a little more care. And by that, I mean quite a number of things, but one of the things I mean is that when we look at an alien species, we really need to be honest with ourselves. We need to look at what it's doing, and we need to add up the good things it's doing as well as the bad things it's doing. And when we've done that honestly and completely, we can look at the whole balance sheet and we can say, okay, here is a species that maybe is really bad and we have to try to do something about it. Or on the other hand, maybe we look at it and we say, well, you know, actually, maybe if you look at the pros and cons, it's not so bad. And anyway, trying to do anything about it would be very expensive. So maybe we shouldn't bother. And the zebra mussel is a brilliant example of that, because you're quite right. You say it fouls pipes, and it certainly does. It fouls pipes, and it fouls the holes of boats, and it certainly does that. Whether it does anything else is very debatable. It's blamed for the decline or extinction of some Native American mollusks, for clams. But whether it is actually involved in that is, as I say, very debatable. There are plenty of people who say that that's not true. On the other hand, we look at zebra mussels, and really, they're quite useful animals. They're filter feeders. That is, they filter food and particles and so on out of the water. And because they're very good at that, they're very good at cleaning water. So a lot of murky, polluted water is now much cleaner and clearer, which is good for fish and good for aquatic plants, than before the zebra mussel came along, because it's really so good at that. And it grows quite fast, and it's quite tasty. So lots of native North American animals like to eat zebra mussels. Crustaceans like it, crayfish, crabs, fish, especially wildfowl. Where you have zebra mussels, you often have many more wildfowl than you did before they invaded. So if you look at zebra mussels, you know, they do bad things. That's absolutely true. But they do good things as well. And on balance, bearing in mind that getting rid of them would be impossible anyway, I think we probably just need to try and fix the technical problem, which is they're sticking to the insides of pipes and the bottoms of boats, and not really worry too much about them otherwise.
Well, I'm going to let the listeners at you here in a second, Ken Thompson, but I want to do one more, and that is the idea of active management of the biosphere, because I get the feeling that you're for it. You're for the gardening of the planet. You're for realizing that when a climate warms, species are become restricted to mountaintops, and somebody needs to help them to propagate from one high elevation to another, that there are actual possible introductions that might be better than some of the disastrous introductions we've had over the years. And I got to say, Ken, that's pretty controversial.
Yes, it is. We're talking here about, specifically if we're talking about climate change, what we're discussing is what conservationists call assisted colonization. And, it's an undeniable fact that as the climate warms, everything has to move. It has to move somewhere cooler. Now, sometimes that's relatively easy. You can move to a north-facing slope instead of a south-facing one, or you can move higher up a mountain. But sometimes it involves moving quite long distances to keep pace with a changing climate. Now, conservationists are very wary of this. It's really not a popular idea at all. And the reason it's not popular is people are terrified of this whole idea of invasive species, because there are indeed a few disaster stories of species which have been moved and have proved to be, problematic. But on the other hand, a lot of these species, they have to move or they're going to go extinct. And so we need to think about that a little more deeply, I think. And it's not as though we don't move species around. Yeah, we move species around the world as it is. We move them because we use them as crops or as animals to eat, or we move them as pets, or we move them as garden plants, or we move them just by accident because they hitchhike on our various modes of transport. So we move lots of species around the world. And a lot of the species that we move are species we don't want to move. So why not move a few of the things that that we like, that we really ought need to move? It's not always the answer. It's not always the answer, but I think we should think more seriously about assisted colonization. Honestly.
So what that brings to my mind is the role of zoos sometimes. If you think of a zoo more as an ark than a public, sideshow, maybe zoos and botanical gardens as well could have really significant roles when you start thinking in terms of active management of the Anthropocene era.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely, zoos and botanical gardens could play major roles, and in fact, some of the more far-sighted zoos and gardens are getting together in networks and figuring out where species, making trial plantings of plants and trial exposures of animals to the natural climate and so on, to see where animals and plants will do well in the future in a changing climate. So people are starting to think about this more than they have in the recent past.
I had an author on about 2 years ago who did a tour of endangered species across the American continent. And, there are a number of them. And one thing that he found out is that rarely were there any that became extinct. In other words, that actually when people decide to intervene, even in the case of the California condor, they actually can stave off extinction, number one. But, number two, he also found that it's not really... Across the entire continent, because of the way the demographics have played out, the development patterns have changed, and there actually is significant rewilding. In other words, there's whole parts of the continent that nobody is real interested in anymore, and that are just rewilding themselves. The real estate's not worth much, and and this is just happening, and yet it's happening without being included in any kind of scientific paradigm, you know, or of ecosystem studies. It's just not fashionable to look at things like that.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right there. This is happening by accident across a lot of the developed world, not just North America. It's happening in North America, certainly. In fact, you know, huge areas of New England are now forest. And in fact, you know, 100 or 200 years ago, they would have been farmland. But they've been abandoned because it's just more profitable and easier to grow those crops and keep those animals somewhere else. So there's this whole rewilding thing that's happening by accident, really. And lots of animals and plants are taking advantage of that. And the same thing is happening in Europe. Big changes in Europe, especially with declining birth rates. I mean, France has a declining birth rate and a fairly, you know, declining population, actually. And huge areas of uplands in France are just being abandoned. And they're going back to forest, and they're going back to wolves, you know, which are otherwise quite rare animals in Europe, and they're going back to lynx and even bears, you know, which are almost extinct in Europe. And all these things are coming back, which is great, really. Which is where that can be allowed to happen. That's wonderful. But there are still lots of places in North America and in Europe where there are so many people that it's really difficult for species to move without any kind of human assistance. There's a very famous example. I won't tell you about it in great detail, but there's a very famous North American example that's been studied in great detail, which is a butterfly called Edith Checkerspot, which lives in California. And it lives in Southern California. And it lives south of Los Angeles. And basically, as the climate warms, studies have shown it really has to move north. There's nothing else for it. It has to. But it can't, because Los Angeles is in the way. And so you either leave it alone, it'll probably go extinct, or you move it, you know, and seems a no-brainer to me.
Oh, yeah, I think there's a phenology angle in that one, too, if I recall correctly. Something about a certain kind of flower that they need that is being ranged out to the south.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, actually. Yeah. And actually, you could the lady who's worked on it, who's an American lady called Camille Parmesan, you could have her on the show and spend the whole hour,
I've
frankly,
tried.
Talking about...
I have
talking about this one butterfly, because it's a terrific story. But
I have tried. Yeah, she's one of my favorite people. That's why I remember the study.
Yeah, she's a great lady, and it's a fabulous story.
I bet you she doesn't go along. I bet you she's
more complicated than I've said there in just that brief snippet there.
Ken Thompson, I can't even imagine. Her going along with some of your assertions here about there's too much alarm about invasive species, though.
No, maybe not.
Maybe not.
She's a confirmed advocate of assisted colonization because, you know, this butterfly that she spent decades working on, she now knows beyond reasonable doubt that it has to be moved or it'll go extinct. So, you know, what do you do?
Very powerful. Let's try a phone call. Trish joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Ken Thompson, Trish.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I find this to be a really interesting topic, and I'm glad you're having it on the show. I do want to point out we have a lot of sophisticated thinkers about biology in Alaska, though it would be great to have a local person talk about this issue. In particular, though, as an indication of that, we don't in Alaska treat all invasive species the same, or rather all non-native species the same, and consider them all bad. A group called the Alaska Natural Heritage Program in Anchorage has developed a very sophisticated invasive species ranking protocol where they rank species from 1 to 100 in terms of what threat they pose to Alaskan ecosystems. And this is really useful for managers to prioritize. Is this species something we need to deal with, or is it something we can just ignore? So I just wanted to point that out, and I will take my answer offline. Thank you.
All right, Trish, too bad, because I think we could have got a nice argument going there. But
No, really. I think Trish and I agree completely there. I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, the people who think about this in the right way and far-sighted managers are absolutely doing the right thing, and what Trish describes is absolutely right. You work out, you sit down and you work out which species are, because let's face it, the resources available for controlling alien species are limited. You know, we have other things to spend our money on, and we really need to make sure we're picking on the ones that really need to be controlled. Now, if you've done that, and you've honestly done that, and you have a species and you say, okay, we know this is doing real measurable harm and we need to do something about it. Not only that, but we think we know what we need to do. In other words, we have a plausible mechanism for dealing with this species. Then I'm with you. Go ahead and deal with it. But that doesn't happen everywhere, trust me. You've read my book. There are plenty of examples in there of where this doesn't happen.
Yeah, you know, I've attended some scientific meetings on the issues of endangered species and invasive species. That's actually a little bit interlinked with endangered when you think about it. But one thing that if you actually start looking at the whole scale of the situation, a great deal of the problems the species actually are being introduced through the pet industry and through the nursery industry, both of which have very powerful lobbies and don't want to be regulated.
Yeah.
So the very thing, absolutely. the way that you have to deal with the invasion is really to catch it really early, and then maybe your measures will actually accomplish something instead of doing more harm than good. But if it's actually coming in through the pet stores and coming in through the nurseries, and they're nobody's giving them any scrutiny, you're basically screwed.
Yeah, absolutely. Not moving species in the first place is clearly the best option, because then they can't escape or become invasive. Now, once you've moved them, then you have a problem, because everyone agrees that if you have a new invasive species, a new alien that's just starting to establish itself in the wild, the best solution is to deal with it while it's still very rare, while it's just at the beginning of becoming a problem. But unfortunately, there are so many species that we move around, and so many of them make this transition from just in a garden or just in a greenhouse or just in a zoo or just in a pet store out into the wild. And it's very, very difficult to keep an eye on them all. You know, you need a really sophisticated monitoring system to keep an eye on these things, because by definition they're hard to spot when they're at this very early stage, because there aren't many of them and no one notices them. And then very often, by the time somebody says, "Hey, wait a minute," you know, there seem to be quite a few of these new plant or this new bird or whatever it is, it's too late. You know, the option of doing something quickly and cheaply has gone. On top of that, we also often don't know whether a new species is actually going to go on to cause a problem. Because by definition, when it's rare, it's usually not causing a problem. So unless we have a species that's been demonstrated to be a problem somewhere else in the world, it's not always easy to know whether it's going to go on to be a problem. It's tough. It's not as simple as it looks.
Not as simple as it looks, and funds are always limited. We're talking to Ken Thompson, author of Where Do Camels Belong, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Alaska Pacific University now offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. More at 1-800-272-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Ken Thompson is author of Where Do Camels Belong? He's with us by telephone from the United Kingdom. And Ken, I'm thinking now of top predators. One thing you said early about the camels and other large mammals were hunted pretty much to extinction on the North American continent by humans. There are consequences for an ecosystem when it loses the top predators. You know, you have an example of the difference between a golden eagle and a bald eagle, for instance, and what they do to the ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's one example where that was an American example where there was an island where you had golden eagles, which were causing a problem, which is a weird example actually, because the golden eagle, of course, is a North American native, but it wasn't native to that particular island, so that's a kind of odd situation. And it turned out that the golden eagles were only there in large numbers because the bald eagles, which are basically fish eaters, had been killed or eliminated by pesticides, which had got into the fish, which got into the eagles. It's one of these complicated stories where you're not quite sure who's the villain and who's the good guy.
What is nice about that story is that it shows that things happen in degrees and increments. That, you know, it's not that the bald eagle is not going to prey on these endangered animals. It's that they're going to eat less of them because they rather have fish, whereas the golden eagles are just all over them.
Yes.
But if you have the bald eagles, they'll supplant the golden eagles because they don't like them around.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, because the bald eagle is a bigger bird and a better competitor. So, but yeah, the whole question that you raise there of management of top predators is crucial, really, in a way, because ecosystems, one of the things ecologists have discovered over the years, and it's not a really big discovery, let's be honest, it's common sense, is that ecosystems mostly have top predators. They have big predators at the top of the food chain, and they only really work properly if those top predators are there. So, and the problem with top predators is that humans don't often get on with top predators very well. So there's a fine line between being a desirable member of an ecosystem and a pest, you know. So, I mean, wolves in North America is one of the classic examples, you know, where they had big, big problems in Yellowstone in the national park there because there were far too many herbivores. There was far too much elk and all these other things and deer eating all the vegetation and stopping the trees growing. And they just couldn't do anything about it. And that's because they'd eliminated the wolves. Well, when they reintroduced the wolves, that sorted the whole problem. There's what happened is what ecologists call a trophic cascade, which basically changed the whole ecosystem and put it back to how it was supposed to be. And everyone was very happy, except the wolves were really successful. And, of course, they begin to spread out of the national park. And once they spread out of the national park,
everyone around says we don't like wolves, you know, because they eat. Well, some people think they're dangerous for people. I mean, they're not really. But they eat sheep and they eat other domestic animals. And people say, oh, we don't like wolves. And hunters who hunt deer say we don't like wolves because they eat the deer. And so, you know, you start shooting the wolves. And you've got this seesaw, basically, situation where you know, we know we have to have these animals. And we know they're essential components of ecosystems. But we like, you know, this is all part of the transformation of the world by humans that I talked about earlier. We yeah. like humans. We like nature, but we like it on our terms. You know, we don't like it to annoy us.
Well, I'll tell you one predator that has been increasing its numbers in Alaska is the coyote. And as a matter of fact, right. all over the North American continent, the coyotes have greatly expanded their range, largely because they're, like you say, human friendly. They don't mind being around people so much, and so they'll eat pets and they'll raid chicken yards and so forth. Whereas the wolves will be far more avoidant of human contact and human sign. And so Bruce Wright at Lucian Pribilof wondered if he had any thoughts about coyotes moving into Alaska. They've added to the diversity, but is that really good?
Yeah, well, this is a really interesting topic, actually. And I'm not really an expert on you know the ecology of coyotes in North America. But if it's anything like the rest of the world, one reason coyotes will be doing really well is because of a decline in the number of wolves. Because right across the world, one of the things that a phenomenon that ecologists discover over and over and over again is a thing called mesopredator release. And that is, if you have a decline in the numbers of the really top predator, the big dominant top predator, what happens is the predators in the next rung down, the sort of middling-sized predators, do much better. Firstly, because there's more to eat, and secondly, because they actually are prey of the top predators. So, and very often this mesopredator release, where you get this expansion of of whatever it is. It happens in your case to be coyotes, but in many parts of the world, it's things like foxes, and they're a real problem. And so we have to bring the big predators back. We have this problem in Britain. We have it. You think you have problems in North America. We have this problem in spades in Britain because we killed all our big predators long ago. So we have mesopredator release on a big scale in Britain. We have foxes, you know, just ordinary red foxes coming out of our ears. You know, they're everywhere. And that's because they're our top predator now. There's nothing bigger to keep them under control.
Let's go to Stu, joins the program from Muldoon. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stu, and thanks for being so patient.
Thanks, Steve. I would like to hear your guest talk about the monoculture problem when we get these invasives that just take over. It's happening now throughout Anchorage with the choke cherry mayday trees. I mean, they're spreading all along Chester Creek, all the way into the military reservation and beyond. You can see them when you fly in late October. There's these green trees popping up everywhere. They're just spread out by the waxwings that eat the berries, and also the pike. Definitely monoculture city in a lot of lakes. Is there any hope? I mean, do monocultures eventually disappear?
Ah, okay. So remind me what this plant is again?
It's called the European choke cherry. I think you have a problem with it in the UK too. There's different varieties, and some are really. It's also called a mayday tree or a bird cherry. Also goes by. They sell them in the stores up here. They basically have. I think it's the cyanide in the bark and the leaves that kills moose. And they take over eventually entire areas. Nothing can grow around them but their own kind. And if you want to see a bunch, just go into Muldoon and walk down the the new park they got there where the greenhouse used to be along the creek, and they're so thick, they grow really fast, you can't walk through them. Nothing else will be able to reproduce berries or birch or spruce. They're just eventually all going to be gone. It's phenomenally horrific.
Yeah. Well, there certainly are plants that seem capable of doing this around the world. Now, it's very difficult to discuss, you know, a particular example without knowing all the details, obviously. But very often there are a number of things to say. One is that these monocultures often do not persist. They often look like they're going to persist, but that's because we look at them, like I said earlier, on a kind of human timescale, and we don't realize what is going to happen to them if we leave them alone. Very often they are what ecologists call early successional species. So they're species which basically thrive on disturbance. So they love to colonize places where humans have gone in and destroyed the native vegetation and messed things up, and they kind of take over. But if you leave them alone, very often they're replaced by native trees, which are bigger and longer lived. So that tends to happen. I mean, an example, it's not your example, but a really nice, well-documented example is gorse in New Zealand, which is a really big problem. But basically, if people leave it alone, it's replaced by native trees. It doesn't. It looks like it's going to last forever, and it does. It lasts for decades. So if you just look at it from one year to the next, you think it's not changing. But if you go back after like 50 years, it's gone. And with any luck, this is what's going to happen to your alien cherry tree here. I also have to say, and this is little comfort, I know, at this stage, but looking into the distant future, what happens to these alien species that become very common is that they attract the attention of native herbivores, insects and things that eat their leaves, and native pathogens that, you know, bacteria and fungi and whatever that live in the soil and start to attack the roots of these plants and so on. So there are lots of really good examples all over the world of alien plants that look like they're just going to take over the planet and just steamroller everything out of the way. And you come back 50 years later, and they're really starting to decline.
Stu?
Oh, thanks. That's encouraging. I think with the warming climate, though, we might be at a more serious disadvantage. I hope you're right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I hope I am.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Stu. And let's go to Gino in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Gino, with Ken Thompson.
Hi, thanks for letting me on the air. Yeah, I wanted to comment that you discussed that it's often too late once an invasive species is found to do something about it. And I wanted to point out that in Alaska, we really have several examples of finding species early and then educating the public to prevent their continued spread. And some of those examples include garlic mustard, which has two known locations in Alaska that are both contained. Giant hogweed, which has only one known location in Alaska that is presently being managed. Spotted knapweed at one point in time had over 20 locations in Alaska and now is down to five. And purple loosestrife, which is well known in the lower 48, really had only one known escape population in Alaska that's been removed, and quite a bit of effort's gone into promoting outreach through that. So through professional surveys and reports from people, the public that calls up groups like Cooperative Extension letting us know about invasive species that they're spotting and the new ones, you know, we're certainly in Alaska making progress towards staying ahead of many of these invasive species that are out there and starting to move into the state.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And well, well done. And if you can involve the public, of course, that helps a lot. I have to say, the examples you mention are ones where the problem of not knowing how the species will behave in the future is not a problem, because these are species which are known to be invasive elsewhere. So it's not as though you have to wait and see what they do, because you kind of know what they're going to do. So it is possible to tackle them at an early stage. Although, I have to say,
you're going to defend loosestrife now,
and
aren't you?
There are some bad guys there. You mentioned giant hogweed, and we have a lot of giant hogweed in Britain, where it's in a few places is a problem. But you mentioned purple loosestrife, which I have to say is one of ours. It's a British plant. Now, purple loosestrife, quite honestly, it's been, because it's such a common plant, it's been studied extensively by ecologists over many decades. And reviews of all that work suggests that really it doesn't do a great deal of harm. I mean, I know if you look at a wetland where there's a lot of loosestrife, that may be hard to believe, actually. But trust me, people who've studied loosestrife extensively in North America have really come to the conclusion that it's not all that much of a problem, and that certainly spending a lot of money on trying to control it is probably a waste of time. But on the other hand, even so, if it's not in Alaska and you can stop it before it arrives, then you don't have to worry about whether that's true or not, do you?
Gino, you know, I'm thinking about the volunteers that go out every year and go up and down the road in Denali Park and yank up all the dandelions, and how because the seeds don't travel all that far, you know, they are kind of keeping dandelions from getting too far in the park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you also recognize that different land managers have different priorities as far as what they're doing. You know, in Alaska, we have quite a few vast open spaces that really haven't been overly impacted by man. You know, not like unlike Europe and as well as most of a lot of the lower 48. And you know, for a group like the Park Service, whose management strategy is to try to preserve something in a natural state, you know, that may make sense. Now, in Anchorage, you won't really see a dandelion pole.
I don't think so. No.
So.
I'm kind of bemused here by the idea of people going around pulling up dandelions. Is that really, happening?
That really does happen. It really, because they don't necessarily migrate all that fast. The seeds are a wind thing, but they actually don't get that far.
Oh, and we have places in the state where really there aren't many dandelions.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I have trouble getting my head around dandelions as an invasive species. I'm sorry. That's just. I'm surrounded by dandelions.
I totally believe that. We're talking to Ken Thompson in the United Kingdom here as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
the Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more.
A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. We're talking about endangered, and I'm saying endangered species, and I'm meaning invasive species in a human-modified world. Ken Thompson is with us. He's author of Where Do Camels Belong? And, you know, there is a there is a linkage, I think, in terms of habitat characteristics between endangered species and invasive species. Because it's often said, well, the invasive species will simplify the ecosystem and render our number of things extinct. But that doesn't really happen. What tends to happen instead is that the population is depressed, but extinction not so often.
No. It's kind of more complicated than that. There's certainly no evidence anywhere in the world of an alien plant causing the extinction of a native plant. That's certainly true. That just doesn't seem to happen. On the other hand, there certainly are occasions where some kinds of alien species, and particularly alien predators, this is not really something that you or I need to worry about, because it's something that happens on islands, especially isolated islands, where if you introduce a predator that encounters an ecosystem that just wasn't expecting to have to deal with predators at all, then you can have really catastrophic problems. This is one of the cases where I'm saying, you know, these are really bad guys, and you know, you really want to do something about them.
Oh yes, we have.
And the textbook example, which I discuss at some length in the book, is the brown tree snake on Guam, which has basically eaten all the birds on Guam, because that's an island that didn't have any predators until the brown tree snake was accidentally introduced, and so they had no defenses against a predator, and so they were easy prey. But that tends to be quite specialized sorts of places. Doesn't really happen on continents like Europe or North America, where you have a kind of mix of animals to start with. Aliens can sort of change things there, but they tend not to drive native species to extinction.
Well, one thing that we had in Alaska that's really a textbook example of what you're talking about was fox farming in the Aleutian Islands, which essentially, you know, there's huge numbers of migratory birds that nest there on those islands because there were no predators there, among other things. And so it was lucrative then to have fox farms to get fur, which Alaska was in the fur trade many different times in different years. And so this was the idea that you actually just foxy. These foxes do great eating all these eggs and so forth. And so you have this all over the Aleutians. And there's been the public lands managers have slowly exterminated foxes from one island after another with remarkable results. In terms of species that were not seen on those islands when the foxes were there, returning, even though it's been many, many years, somehow there are still some seeds of these giant grasses and things like that were still able to come back once the foxes were gone and they got all that guano, you know, which, of course, is a great fertilizer, as any gardener would know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's an example that I'm not personally familiar with, I have to say, but it sounds absolutely typical, you know. Moving generalist predators to predator-free islands is, experience suggests, always a bad idea.
Yeah, and Bruce Wright, who I kind of wish had been with us on the program here, because he's extremely knowledgeable, especially about predators in Alaska, he keeps throwing me emails, and the latest one is passenger pigeon extinction likely happened because of Trichomonas brought to North America by European pigeons.
Is that right?
that's what Bruce is telling us. And so,
I didn't. Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, I've, I I have the story everyone gets told in school, you know, about them just being hunted to extinction. But I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised. I have to say, very often the simple story turns out to be not necessarily wrong, yeah. But on the other hand, not necessarily complete either.
Well, I think your underlying message of all this, Ken Thompson, is that we've already changed our ecosystem, and we need to start taking responsibility for that and living with it and setting priorities in some kind of rational way that lines up with these responsibilities. Because as you say, our own activities are certain kind of plants with certain kind of seeds. It's going to hang onto our clothes and go wherever we go. And we're going to spread those without any intention whatsoever. Maybe if we exercise a little intention, we can actually get some stuff done.
Yeah, absolutely. We're never going to turn the clock back to some kind of pre-human, pristine paradise, because there are too many of us now, and we've changed the world in such a big way, and there's going to be more of us in 50 years' time, and we need more land for cities and more land for crops and more land for animals, and we're just going to go on changing the planet even more. And so, in a sense, invasive alien species are one of the least of our worries, frankly. When you look at habitat loss and pollution and climate change, this is why I'm saying realistically, we can't get rid of most of these alien species. They're here to stay. So we need to figure out how to live with them. And only in a very few cases, like predators on islands, do we need to really try hard to try and actually exterminate them.
And so there are some people just raising the alarm, and you don't think, you think the alarm is not necessarily warranted?
Yeah, not always. I take the point. I take the point absolutely of one of your earlier callers who said, in Alaska we have this system where we absolutely look at these things objectively and
okay,
we prioritize what's good and what's bad.
Out of time, Ken Thompson. Thank you so much.
Okay.
For being with us. And I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University, a private nonprofit committed to personalized experiential learning that incorporates Alaska as its principal classroom. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.